Welcome to Mysterious Universe Plus, Season 14, Episode 10. Coming up on this show, we've got the Lunatics of Lycanthropy, Willix the Warlock, and the Secret Dragon Cults of Loch Ness. I'm Benjamin Grundy, joining me is Aaron Wright.
Willix the Warlock, that sounds kind of Renaissance fairish.
He's an awesome guy. Real guy from history. The second person in the known records to have fought and defeated the Loch Ness Monster.
Hang on. Known records of someone fighting the Loch Ness Monster.
Yeah.
Is this going to be another Minotaur story?
No, this is all real.
It's Does not the Loch Ness Monster heads. Have a massive penis?
I can't prove that he didn't have temporal lobe epilepsy. He fought the Loch Ness Monster and he just woke up covered in blood. Has no memory of what actually happened.
It was so awkward on the weekend, actually, because a friend of mine came over and they've only just come back from overseas. And he's like, oh, what's been happening with MU? I'm like, well, you should be listening to the show. He's like, oh, I haven't had a chance. And I said, oh, yeah, we just covered this great story on a guy that fought a Minotaur. And for some reason, the entire time as I'm sitting there looking him in the eye, I keep on thinking, giant penis. I couldn't stop. I couldn't get it out of my head.
I have that problem, too, when I meet people. Just having the Minotaur penis in my mind.
No, but it's like that whole psychology concept of don't think about the pink elephant. I'm trying to tell a coherent story, yeah. And all I've got is the Minotaur
it's
penis.
It's like a weird form of MU Tourette's. You know?
Yes.
In your mind, you might be talking to perhaps your bank manager on getting a new loan, and all of a sudden he'll be giving you details and you'll just go, Minotaur penis!
That happened once, okay? Give me a break.
I don't know why that is a story that sticks, but it certainly did.
Oh, it did something, that's for sure. Well, actually, I have stories of werewolf or weremen type encounters coming up. It's not very a big story, but it's an ongoing story. It's a developing story, so I'm looking forward to covering it.
In all seriousness, our stories actually line up in a nice way. I'm doing Nick Redfern's brand new book, Nessie, Exploring the Supernatural Origins of the Loch Ness Monster. I think this is Redfern at his best, just piecing together these tales and drawing connections that, as we said on our last show, you only see once you start looking at this stuff for a long period of time. And in many of the old Kelpie legends, Loch Ness Monster comes from the folklore of the Kelpie.
Yeah.
They're considered to be shapeshifters. And there's a lot of crossovers with werewolf lycanthropy. There's all these tales of...
Really?
Sometimes the Kelpie, it was a shapeshifter, so it could appear as a handsome man to lure you into the lake if you were a female. It could appear as a voluptuous woman to lure you into the lake, much like the drownings in fairy folklore. But also, the only way you could kill a Kelpie was with silver. Or a silver bullet.
Which lines up with vampires, right?
Well, lines up with werewolves. Don't you kill werewolves with silver?
Oh, I didn't think... Oh, good point.
Come on, brush up on your werewolf teen werewolf 2016 knowledge.
Look, all I know is that they sparkle when you take them out. Oh, that was vampires as well. That's right. I'll work it out eventually. Look, let's get into the news to start off this show. And some great new research has come out of the University of Tokyo, where the lead scientist, Satoshi Ide, has found that there is a link between earthquakes and the phases of the moon.
Hasn't this moon-lunatic connection already been debunked?
Well, yeah, good point, very good point. It has been debunked in the past in relation to human activity. So going back, I don't know, maybe 200 or 300 years, there has been a belief, and obviously it's the term lunar, as in lunacy, crazy, that the phases of the moon or a full moon can actually cause people to act in psychotic fashions. And there's a little bit of science backing it up. I mean, back in 2009, Scientific American looked into this and they found out that there was a study that was conducted in the late 1980s. And they found that when there was a full moon, there was an increased incidence of traffic crashes and incidents that are like that. However, when they actually looked at the data, they found that the full moon was always falling on a weekend, which is associated with an increase in activity anyway.
You always hear anecdotes from emergency workers and doctors and nurses as well that when it's a full moon, that's when you get the majority of accidents.
And absolutely. Yeah, if you go through Reddit, and I actually had a look on Reddit, and there are all of these very just short subreddits talking about people that have had incidents. So they work in retail, or they work in emergency rooms, or they work in the police force, and they find that when it's a full moon, the crazies certainly come out. But in 2013... there was a study that was conducted in Australia that found that people's sleep is actually affected by the phase of the moon. And when there's a full moon, people slept 30% less and they took 5 minutes longer to get to sleep than normal. And they had obviously disturbed sleep patterns. And there's some suggestion that those disturbed sleep patterns can be enough to upset the neurochemical balance in someone's mind. And people that are already kind of on the edge from stress and whatever else may then be pushed over, leading them to commit violent acts or act in more psychotic fashion.
Well, with the new study from the University of Tokyo, this is where the moon's affecting seismic activity.
That's right. This
leads to the question of, does seismic activity affect human behavior?
Well, going all the way back to the concept of lunacy, I think it might have been the Japanese themselves back in the late 1800s or the early 1900s that suggested that because the human brain is a moist organ, and of course we know that the moon affects the tides, how is it that then it can't affect the human mind because it's wet and there's lots of water? But come on, I mean, the human body is 80% water. So it wouldn't just be the brain that's affected. But when we look at something from a wider scale, from a scientific perspective, it's true. Japanese scientists have found that when there is a full moon, there is an increased risk of earthquakes. And this comes from the fact that, yes, of course, the moon does affect the Earth's tides. But essentially, the Earth's crust is sitting atop the mantle and moving across a liquid, essentially. And when you have the moon, the influence of the gravity upon the Earth's crust might actually cause stress to increase earthquakes. So we know that the plates are constantly rubbing up against each other.
Right.
That happens all the time. But as they rub up against each other, if it just so happens that there's these little micro fractures that start underground, if it's not a full moon, they may not slip. They may not break down and cause a massive earthquake. However, when there's just a little bit extra pressure, the scientists are suggesting that when the moon is full or waxing, it can actually cause those little pressure points to actually break a lot sooner than they would, resulting in, I guess, a cumulative effect of a larger earthquake. And they've backed this up. They found that the December 26, 2004 Sumatran earthquake fell on a full moon. Same with the one that happened in 2010 in Chile, fell on a full moon. And finally, the biggest one, which was the one that happened in Japan off the coast of Fukushima and caused a massive tsunami, it fell on a full moon. So there's a lot of data in here suggesting that there is some type of activity going on. And the study didn't find any correlation between the tides and smaller earthquakes, but there is other research out there to suggest that there is actually some type of link.
So is the solution to stop cities like San Francisco from being wiped out by the eventual big one to destroy the moon? Is that the solution?
I don't necessarily think that is the solution. I think it comes down to the fact that the Earth and the moon are in this symbiosis and there's nothing that we can do. And of course, if we got rid of the moon, it would upset tides. It would cause a whole cataclysm of problems for us.
I like how you're buffering your werewolf section with all this science stuff just to pad it a little bit. You'll notice I don't have any stories about plesiosaurs before my Nessie segment. I'm just going straight into it without any fear at all.
Well, let me
explain. I don't need science to back up my Nessie content.
The reason why I've included this is because it's not actually trying to back up werewolves at all. The way that this happened, this is my process. This is my muse. This is how I get the show together. I actually found the article first on The Atlantic about the study backing up earthquakes and moon activity. And immediately I thought, oh, that reminds me of the strange reports of people saying that, you know, there's an increase of violent activity during full moons. And I thought, what else do you hear? Oh, there's always the folklore of werewolves or human beings turning into werewolves on a full moon. So I Google it. And of course, who comes up? None other than the excellent Linda Godfrey.
And When's the new book coming out? October the 11th.
Yes.
Monsters Among Us, an exploration of otherworldly Bigfoots, Wolfmen, portals, phantoms, and odd phenomena. We're going to try and get it on in October, right?
Yes, that's right. I'm thinking I'm going to aim for Halloween, even though our work is more important, obviously, than just Halloween, but it kind of fits with the time of the year.
It does fit.
So this story is fantastic. It's come out from a witness who chose to remain anonymous because her story is quite unusual and disturbing for her, but Linda decided to call her Jessie just for the sake of the story. But this all happened in Pennsylvania, and Jessie has been enduring some type of strange werewolf-like situation for 4 years now. And this all began back in October of 2013 when she was out hiking in the woods near her home and sensed an eerie change in the atmosphere. Now, this sounds very much like the Oz effect, which we hear from people like John Keel and Jenny Randles as well, where when paranormal activity takes place, it seems like everything else kind of just shuts off. The world closes down. And Jesse says, the stillness and the pre-dawn glow of the forest around me seemed somehow off. I couldn't put my finger on it, but something wasn't right. The light was coming in like normal. It infiltrated the woods, but everything had this strange glow to it. I decided to end my walk and go back to my car, but as I got close to where my car was parked, I got a whiff of something rotten. I thought it was just the deer carcass lying near the side of my truck that looked like it had been hit by a car the night before. But then I heard something shuffling around the same spot as the deer. I started to hear something dragging, and I walked slowly towards my car in case it may have been a bear. She says, I turned to see a very large thing, it's the only way I can describe it, on two legs. It was kind of hunched over the deer carcass and was dragging it with its claws, digging into the meat of the deer. It was mostly brown with a bit of grey on it. But when it saw me, it stood all the way up and turned to face me. It had blazing yellow eyes that seemed to stand out more than any animals normally would. It had a snout that was something like a husky or a German shepherd, and its teeth were fully bared, and it gave me a very low and menacing growl. Jessie says she was frozen, she couldn't breathe, she couldn't move. She said, I thought my eyes were going to pop out of my head. The thing was towering over me. I'm 5'1", but my neck was cramped looking up at this thing. It had to be close to 7 or 8 feet tall, if not taller. My heart was hammering so fast that I thought it was going to explode. He growled a second time and licked his bare teeth and took a step towards me. It had let go of the deer carcass and its claws were free and curled, ready for action. Now, Jesse, obviously, after taking a moment to pause and freak out and process what she's seeing, broke into this run to a driver's side door, jumped in the car just as this thing lunged her in the vehicle. And as it did, it scraped down the side of her car.
She said it was like a half lunge.
Yes.
Almost as if it didn't actually want to connect with her. It was just a warning to leave.
That's right. And she was fumbling with her keys as she was in the car. Obviously, she was panicking. And she said it scratched down the back window, making a horrible, high-pitched squeaking noise. And then it dug its hand or its claws into the trunk and into the paint. But it was almost like it was just taunting her, because it could have jumped and done more, but it didn't seem to. It was just hanging around the back. She said, I threw the car into drive, hit the gas, and got out there. I looked in the rearview mirror and saw him grab the deer carcass and drag it back into the woods near the trail opening. I just drove and drove, shaking still.
Now, he parks next to a deer carcass.
Oh, who knows? I mean, these are small details which are kind of irrelevant. I mean, if there was maybe other cars there or there was nowhere else to park, it would make sense that you're not going to move it. You're not going to get out of your car and move it. And if it's a regular occurrence, it's not
a big deal. Is it that regular that you just pull up and there's a deer carcass there and you're like...
How often do you pull up at rest stops here in Australia and find that there's a dead kangaroo or a wombat or something else lying inside the
road? Yeah, I guess it's pretty frequent.
See, it happens quite frequently. So I wouldn't be surprised if there are a lot of deers around this area that the same thing would happen. We're focused on the wrong details. I mean, the woman has just seen a wolfman or canid-type bipedal creature.
Oh, excuse me for wanting to find out if this is real or not.
Now, she said that as she was looking into her rear vision mirror, she had this feeling come over her, and that persisted into later in the day. And she was actually at this event. Now, in the first report, she didn't give any details about what this event was. And she turns up and she was preoccupied and people were saying, what's wrong? She's like, I can't tell you, I can't tell you. It was her wedding day.
Wow.
So she'd gotten up in the morning she used to be in the army and she'd regularly happily go into the woods and she would get up and go and de-stress. And of course, being her wedding day, she thought it was a great day to go and de-stress and see the sunrise. And
seeing a wolf man is the opposite of de-stressing.
Well, it's one hell of a wedding gift, that's for sure. So she went and searched around the internet looking for people that had had similar experiences as hers. And of course, she found Linda Godfrey. And she went to email Linda to tell her about her story. But before she did, she said she had this strange experience yet again. She'd almost forgotten about the creature, but almost as if it was just giving her a nod or, you know, just giving her a little bit of attention. She was sitting one night on her backyard deck listening to music when she suddenly felt a stare. She said there was this chill in the air and my hair stood on end and I looked and there he was. It almost felt like he was giving a warning to me. He was standing on the edge of the woods of my backyard along the fence. And as he stared at me, I could see those horrible yellow eyes. Now, she went inside, and as soon as she did, the creature also retreated. But that's when she immediately contacted Linda and said, I need to talk to you. I need to see you. And I think that that's kind of important because, yes, there are people out there that will make up these stories. But for someone to actually go to the point where they want to speak with a researcher and physically see them, I think that adds a little bit more credence to their experience. I'm not saying totally, because there are some nutjobs out there that'll do it, but to go to the point of actually wanting to see a researcher, it makes me think that they are genuinely freaked out by something that they're experiencing.
Well, Linda's posted this on her website, so does that mean that she's actually interviewed this eyewitness?
Yes, she has. So what happened was is that Linda said, I can't get out to see you, but the best thing you should do, just coming from other advice that I have, is to put on motion-sensitive lights around your home. So if the creature approaches, at least the lights will come on and maybe scare it away. But things start to change. So she's gotten married and everything's been fine. This thing has shown up on the edge of her property. She hasn't really thought much of it since, apart from the fact that she contacted Linda. But she said that she awoke one night in her bedroom being a little bit distressed, and found her grandfather standing at the end of the bed. She said she rubbed her eyes, gulped down some water, looked back up, and he was still standing there watching her, and then he spoke. Don't, he said. Don't do it. Don't go after them. You don't know what they really are. Don't. And Jesse said he meant it. He disappeared after that, but he left me with this sense of horrible dread. Now, Jessie was disturbed by this visitation and said she had reoccurring nightmares ever since. And she's been awaking with this sense that there is something around. There's something in the air. And she said her hair again would stand up on the back of her neck. And the cat also would intently look out the window in that arched kind of position, looking like it's freaked out by something. Now, on June the 9th in 2015, Jessie wrote into Linda and said that she had found these indented prints outside her home and scratches along the house siding. And she included the photos. And there's not a lot there. There's some trampled petunias and there's a little bit of, disturbance in the ground. You can't necessarily say that it's a paw print of some kind, but you can see that there is some type of damage to the ground and to the house as well. There are scratch marks on the house. And the one thing that wasn't included in here, which I would be intrigued to ask, is are there any scratch marks on the vehicle? If this creature was attacking the vehicle at first, you would think that there would be marks showing up on the vehicle that might indicate, because you're not going to scratch up your car unless you're really kind of, you know, making it up.
You want to take the hoax to the next level. That's what you're saying.
Yeah, exactly.
Because honestly, that photo of the footprint in the garden is not even worth posting.
Yeah, but the scratch marks are, I think, there are three separate scratch marks that you can see along the siding of this house. So I still think that something's going on. But you can see where the tide is sort of changing. And I don't know what to think about this story, but I think back to the reports of high strangeness that you get from John Keel. It's just odd that she's seen this creature and then all of a sudden she has her grandfather appearing in her bedroom in a spectral form warning her not to mess with something.
Yeah, that's a cool little twist to the story.
It is, and it makes me think, well, is this some type of psychological response? I'm not saying that she didn't have this experience, but is she so freaked out by her encounter with this wolfman or dogman or whatever it is that her subconscious has projected her grandfather into her bedroom saying, just leave it alone, don't mess with it because you just don't know what's going to happen? Or is it genuine that there's some type of weird war going on between these creatures and something that's supernatural?
Or does she have some kind of temporal lobe epilepsy, migraine auras, or early onset dementia?
That's a possibility. And of course, the encounter continues. On June the 11th in 2015, she was awakened to a familiar sense that the creature was outside. This time she got up and peeked through the side of the blinds, only to see it standing right there. She said, I saw the ears, the eyes, and the teeth. The ears were upright dog ears. The eyes were the bright yellow-orange. They were like an amber colour, and they seemed to glow. It didn't see me peeking at first, but once we locked eyes, it let out a tremendous, deep-throated growl and bared its teeth. It turned and ran into the woods behind our house. Essentially, pretty much the same space where she'd seen it come out before. So it's kind of liked this particular area where it would come and go. But she said she estimated the creature was still over 6 feet tall and it ran into the woods. She tried to wake up her husband and her husband didn't wake up. Yet another sort of experience which is tied in with things like abductions, for example, where someone reports that they've had an abduction experience, they try to wake up other members of the house and no one seems to wake up. And she says that she tried to record some of the sounds. She's got a video which is included on the website, which I'll link to at mysteriousuniverse.org. I'm not going to play it because it's just, I don't know if it will come through.
You don't think it's that good?
Do you want to give it a try?
Yeah, this is it.
Oh, wow. I can't believe you had that ready to go.
I think this may be hoaxed.
That was not the sound.
That sounds that
was...
like Godzilla.
Did you get that from, what's her name? Well, Jennifer Murphy and her I Want to Be Ninja?
The reason I have so many samples loaded up and ready to go is because I felt so disappointed with myself on the last Plus extension because I didn't have any Lord of the Rings samples lined up
for
the Minotaur fight.
That was
I had to do it with my mouth, and it was terrible.
It was terrible.
It's really bad. So I've totally made up for it. I've got all sorts of monster sounds coming up.
So what, Godzilla?
Godzilla.
Right, okay. Right, I'm looking forward to that. Back to the story, though. On July the 14th, 2015, Linda says Jesse wrote to me again to say a little after 2 a.m., I was starting to doze off in my bedroom after staying up late with a good book, and I heard this massive slam against the back door. It was as if a linebacker had just thrown himself full force into the back of our house. It even rattled the chain and the deadbolt inside the door. She says, I jumped up and ran out to the kitchen, and standing on the back deck were those two bright, glowing yellow eyes. The wolf beast was standing on two legs, hunched down and snarling at the door. It growled and let out a sort of roar. She says, I ran to my bedroom and tried to grab my phone to video it, but by the time she got back, the creature had disappeared. She tried to wake up her husband and her husband wouldn't respond. So by this point, you would think that either she's making it up or she's going crazy or she's having some type of epileptic fit, as you say, Ben. Something's
pretty
going on.
Elaborate hoax at this stage.
It's exactly. And the fact is, I mean, Linda points out that for some people, they have ongoing encounters. But finally, in August of this year, August 2016, a friend was visiting the property without any knowledge of her ongoing encounters with this wolfman type creature. And Jessie wrote to Linda and said, one day she came to me as she was visiting me and she said that she saw the shadow. She didn't see the face, but she could see in the tree line where this thing normally would come through, a furry outline, the ears and the glowing yellow eyes standing out. And Linda points out that the fact that two people saw it kind of rules out the idea that Jessie's just having an hallucination. There's something more which is going on here. Whether or not it's a real creature, we can't tell because there's supernatural elements that are included here with the grandfather appearing, but other people have been seeing it. It's gotten to the point now where Jesse has decided the best way that they can solve this is to actually move from that location in Pennsylvania. Mm-hmm. Linda has said, yep, that's the best way to solve it. Sometimes putting distance between it and the creature is the best way to get out of there. So I'll link to that in the show notes. It's a great story. And as I said, Linda has said that this is an ongoing case. So if any more details come in, she'll put them up on her blog.
I'm sure this story will be just one of many in that new upcoming book.
Yes, I'm sure.
I really want to get her on so we can ask her, are these people telling the truth? You know, when you go and interview them, do you get the sense that they're genuine?
You know, we've got Dr. Artie Six Killer Clark coming up this week. I've got an interview with her early tomorrow morning, so I'll just be doing it because I think it's too early.
The crack of dawn.
Yeah, it is very early, but I'm so excited to talk to her because her new book has just dropped and I've been reading through it for the past couple of weeks getting ready for this interview because her stories are always so great. But I must say, I'm looking forward to asking her a very similar question because some of the stories are so outlandish that I want to understand, what does she think of them? Does she actually believe that these people are having these experiences or is there something else going on here? But it makes me think that it's a lot of effort to go to put on a hoax like this, especially when these people want to remain anonymous. And I must say, I think maybe for these researchers, as with us, after you've been doing something long enough, you tend to be able to spot the stories that are just someone making something up. You can tell. You can kind of tell. I mean, sometimes I get caught if it's a late night, but other times I think I can tell the difference between someone telling a real story and someone being disingenuous.
Well, the key with these tales isn't to think that, well, there's a bunch of people who are seeing wolf-like or dog-like humanoids. The key isn't to conclude that it's either fake or there must be some kind of
physical
population of these things walking around in the wilderness in Pennsylvania. I don't think that adds up either. But especially, again, in reference to last week's episode and our discussion with Anthony Peake, it really refers to our understanding of the nature of reality. I mean, that's what it comes down to. That's essentially what Nick Redfern is arguing for in his latest book, Nessie, where he's, again, challenging this common cryptozoological position that these are undiscovered flesh and blood physical creatures. and, you know, approaching it from that angle. Yeah. Whereas, again, when you go back and you flip the nature of reality on its head,
yeah.
it starts to allow for subtleties of existence where I think things like Nessie, things like these strange wolf humanoid sightings, things like Sasquatch, they all fit within that.
Absolutely. But I think, I guess, for the general population, it's almost easier to accept the possibility that there is some type of undiscovered flesh and blood species out there as opposed to it being supernatural. People are like, oh, I don't believe in Bigfoot. But if you start probing them and you say, well, I mean, could it be possible that there's an undiscovered species out there? And then people, I think most people tend to go, oh, it's possible, it's possible. But the moment that you suggest, well, what if he's interdimensional? It's like, oh, you're crazy! You know what I mean? I think it's easier for people to go, yes, it's just undiscovered, as opposed to the fact that we have to look at the nature of consciousness. I think it's too hard for people at the moment because we are caught in this materialist reductionist kind of world.
But we're not everyday people, and our listeners especially are not those people.
Not by now. If you've been listening for a while, they're not like that at all by now.
Well, let's take a break. When we come back, I'm going to go into Nick Redfern's Nessie, exploring the supernatural origins of the Loch Ness Monster. Amazing stories coming up. No minotaurs, I promise, but much, much worse. Nick Redfern's latest, Nessie, exploring the supernatural origins of the Loch Ness Monster, just hit the Amazon store. It came out on September the 8th. It's available now on Kindle as well. So I picked up a copy. It's been on my radar for a while. I'm not always super excited about more serpent stories.
Yeah, I know, because unfortunately it's almost like you see something unidentified in the water. Okay, move on.
But what Nick does in this book is what Nick does at his best.
It's just dig deep, right?
He makes all these connections, and for a while now he's been on this, well, he's taken this position that a lot of cryptozoology is not flesh and blood creatures.
Yes, yeah.
There's something supernatural to it, and he really makes a great case for this with this latest book. He starts off in the early chapters talking about the common theories over what Nessie or Nessies may be, and when you think about it, I think most people would go to the plesiosaur explanation.
Yes.
That's some kind of surviving population of dinosaurs, basically.
Well, one of the biggest theories I've always heard is that there is some type of hidden tunnel or access to the ocean that's down at the bottom of the loch, and this surviving group of plesiosaurs or whatever breed there and then swim out to the ocean.
Whichever way you spin it, it's a surviving prehistoric animal that's still in the loch today. You also have the idea of giant salamanders. That one's been floated a few times. Giant eels could be culprits. Then there's other scenarios. He mentions like giant sturgeons, oversized turtles.
That's what we always get. If we ever post anything about Nessie on our site and it goes to Facebook, people are like, it's sturgeons, it's sturgeons.
Look at this photo of a giant sturgeon I found online. Case solved. Catfish is another one.
Yes.
Even crocodiles has been a suggestion.
Really? Isn't it too cold?
Well, there are a few sightings where the eyewitnesses said, you know, it kind of had a face like a crocodile.
Interesting.
Giant frogs and hippopotami, which is one of my favourites.
I like
the idea that it's just an undiscovered pod of hippos in Scotland freezing their asses off.
Yeah.
They just hate it there.
I like that.
But he says after more than 80 years of intensive investigation, Nessie or Nessies still evade capture. They still evade discovery, classification. Redfern asks, is this all down to sheer bad luck and inept investigations? Certainly not. Rather, it's a case of people looking for the answers in the completely wrong direction.
Mm.
He said it's time for a fresh approach to solving the mystery. It's an approach that takes us down terrifying paranormal and occult pathways and leads us into a dark realm inhabited by Nessies that are far removed from the flesh and blood creatures that so many people believe, want, or assume them to be.
What, satanic Nessies?
Well, we do have weird scorpion cults. No, not scorpion cults. Arachnid Spider-Men cults coming up.
Great. Okay.
So it definitely gets very dark and occult, which is why I really like this book. The early chapters, again, take us through these first ever discovered records of something being in Loch Ness. The earliest account comes from St. Admanan's Vita Columbae, which translates in English to The Life of Columba. And it's really about this chronicle of the life of St. Columba. It's all in Gaelic. And Columba was a 6th century abbot in Ireland at the time. He was trying to convert all the local Picts in Scotland to Christianity.
Okay.
And this account occurred in 563. So very, very early. Columba sailed to Scotland and he happened to visit Loch Ness while he was there. And upon visiting the lake, according to this story, St. Columba, who was an abbot and he had all his men with him, they're approaching the shore of the lake and they see some locals digging a grave and there's this horrible disfigured body they're trying to bury. So Columba asked the local men what on earth happened, and they said our poor friend, our poor fellow was swimming in the lake and he was bitten by a sea monster. Look how bad the bite is. It's killed him. Mm-hmm. And they were in the process of burying him.
So this was medieval times, right?
563 is the year. Now, bizarrely with this story, St. Columba looks across the lake and there's a boat attached to a cable on the opposite side of the bank and he needs the boat. I don't know all the details of the story as to why he needs the boat. So after hearing and seeing this story of a man nearly bit in two by a creature in the loch,
why not go in?
What St. Columba does is he turns to one of his assistants and goes, you see that boat over there?
Oh, God.
We need it. And you, being the brave lad you are to swim across to that boat and retrieve it for me. So this young man's name was Lugne Mokumin, and under his breath, I'm sure he swore a fair bit, but it was a saint. You're not going to refuse your saint.
No.
So he proceeds to take off his clothes and jump into the water and start to swim across the lake. And guess what happens?
I didn't expect that, but along the
way. As he's swimming across the loch, a huge force comes rising out of the water. It strikes down on him. It starts swimming towards him. The whole group, the St. Columba, the abbot, and all his followers there, struck with fear. But St. Columba doesn't miss a beat. Out of his monk's robe, he pulls out his cross of Christ.
Uh-huh.
And he starts yelling at the sea serpent.
The power of Christ compels you.
That's exactly what he says. I mean, there's a direct quote of it in the book, but I'm not going to read it because it's very old-timey. But yeah, that's what he says. The power of Christ compels you, sea serpent. The monster amazingly proceeds to obey the commands of St. Columba.
Oh, come on.
And retreats and doesn't attack the swimmer. The man's able to retrieve the boat and everyone goes on their way.
See, those old stories, I think, are just, I don't know, a way to fluff up religion at the time.
A way to promote Christianity to the natives you were trying to convert.
I mean, the Simpsons got it right. There's a Halloween special they did years ago where essentially three witches show up at the door. He's like, come on in and take a look at this, and throws up a cross. And of course, they're just like, oh, please. You really think that supernatural creatures give a damn about a cross? They don't.
Well, this is all woven into the folklore. And of course, we're talking about a story that is so incredibly old.
Reliable.
But that is the first written record we have, and you would presume that the folklore in the region would be much older than that. And this is, again, he's totally right. Redfern suggests this. This is a way for Christianity to establish its power in the folklore.
Yeah, it can fend off monsters.
Yeah, the next record we have from history is from 1503, and there was an old manuscript that was discovered that was filled with all tales and of strange and legendary creatures, fire-breathing dragons and wyverns and hellhounds and that kind of thing. And it was just this little note in this manuscript on how the very last Scottish dragon had been killed.
Mm-hmm.
But the author of this old manuscript noted in this section that although the last dragon of Scotland had been killed, the monsters of the loch remained.
Right, okay.
So again, just another little mention that there was something in the loch. Because occasionally you will find debunkers or skeptics of the whole Loch Ness idea as saying that the whole thing started in 1933.
Yeah, when that photograph came out, right?
With the photo, and that was the origin of the legend, but it's completely false. There's been a very strong history of folklore in the region, and of course, within the folklore of much of Scotland, you hear tales of Kelpies. Now, these are centuries old, these legends, but Kelpies are basically supernatural, violent, shape-shifting creatures, and it translates to English as water horses. But as I said, they can shift into any shape, whether it's a young maiden or a handsome man, and lure you into the lake, much like we've heard from other fae folklore. The modus operandi is to drown the target, victim, and take them to the world of the fae.
Isn't it intriguing, though, how you have these mythologies that show up all around the world? You've got the Kappa trying to lead people in and drown them in Japan. You've got the old German folk tales. I think it was the Silks or something, but they would have, there'd be a horrible monster at the bottom of this waterway, and you would have these beautiful daughters that would summon men in and drown them.
Well, most sightings of Kelpies in the region and in the lore state that it'll appear as a lone black horse, and it'll lure the victim to ride it, mount its back.
Yep.
And in a lot of these cases, the victim is in an altered state. There's something about the horse that puts them in a daze.
Yes.
And they feel compelled to join it. They feel compelled to ride it. As soon as they get on its back, it plunges into the water and drowns the rider.
Mm-hmm.
Now, when you look at this in the terms of folklore, you could surmise that, okay, anywhere there's a body of water in Scotland, you're going to have folklore about Kelpies or spirits in that body of water. It's naturally going to occur.
Yeah.
Maybe it's a fairy tale to warn children so that they don't drown accidentally.
Yep.
And anywhere there's any kind of body of water, you're going to have that legend. Well, it turns out that's not correct.
Really?
A legendary folklore researcher, his name's Roland Watson. He's an expert on Kelpie folklore and other Scottish folklore. And he started to research all the pre-1933 publications of the folklore, whether it was a 1,000-year-old manuscript or an old book from the 1600s. He was cataloguing all of it, and he found that 43.6% of the reports came from Loch Ness, and many of the bodies of water just didn't have a legend associated with them.
Interesting.
There was never any Kelpie thing written about it ever, but Loch Ness specifically had the largest percentage, but also his work showed that there were other lochs, other large bodies of water very close to Loch Ness that also had tales of Kelpies and serpents. So the idea was that perhaps in the past, if there was some kind of, let's go back to this idea of flesh and blood population, that it was migrating between these bodies of water.
That is cool. If that's true, that's very cool.
Now, this is where we get into the tale of Willocks the Warlock.
Mm-hmm.
And his real name was Gregor MacGregor, but his nickname was Willocks. And he was famously known as a warlock in the town of Inverness. But on October the 16th, 1833, after his death, he was so famous for being a warlock, the newspaper did this huge obituary on him. And they wrote in it that Willocks the Warlock Gregor was the last of a line of ancestors long the object of awe and veneration, as the possessors of the only means ever known of prying into the future and of controlling and circumventing the works of both natural and supernatural agents. So even the newspaper had something on how this guy was a wizard.
Yes.
And when...
Was he like an alchemist? Is that where we're heading? Or,
well, I'm glad you asked that question, because when Willocks the Warlock was queried on how he gained his powers, and it says there he could pry into the future, so I assume people would go to him for
scrying
predictions
or whatever.
And scrying. Yeah. To answer the question of how he got his powers, he said he obtained them from a Kelpie.
Oh.
And he tells this story of how one evening he was walking along the loch, and a horse loomed into view in the moonlight. Now, he knew that this wasn't a horse because he was quite a perceptive person. He knew that this was actually a Kelpie. There was something off about this horse, something supernatural about it. And as he realized this wasn't a friendly horse, he pulled out his giant claymore and proceeded to chop the horse in the head.
Oh.
Now, he said the horse, or the Kelpie in disguise, had a piece of yellow metal that resembled like a horse's bridle around it. And as he picked up on the ruse, he pulled his claymore's like a giant two-handed sword.
Yep.
Huge thing. He launches the claymore at the horse. And as he's doing so, he strikes it in the nose and it releases part of this yellow metal that looked like a horse's bridle. Now, Willix, he goes to pick up the metal and he's waiting for this Kelpie to strike. But instead of striking, it starts talking to him. Now, this Kelpie started to beg that he give back the bridle. He give back the piece of the yellow metal. And this conversation ensues where it's kind of like the tale of, the Satan whispering in Jesus's ear with temptations. The Kelpie is using all these manipulations to try and get him to hand over the bridle. He's promising him riches. He's promising him power.
Is this some type of amulet for the creature?
Well, eventually, Willix starts to question, what is this? What am I holding and why do you want it so bad?
Yeah.
And he actually tricks the Kelpie. He says, if you tell me what it is, I'll give it back to you. So the Kelpie actually admits that this is actually it's what gives me my power. It's what gives me my uncanny abilities. And without it, I have nothing.
Mm.
And then Willix says, ha, 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 sucker, I'm keeping it for myself. And he proceeds to walk back home.
Does he himself then turn into some horse-type creature?
Well, as he's walking back home, the weird Kelpie creature that's now transformed into this odd serpent is whispering in his ear the whole way back, going, please, please give me back my bridle. Please give it back to me. Its explanation of its power was that when you looked through the holes in the bridle, it would give you second sight.
Oh, and that's how he was doing all the scrying.
Yeah, so he's resisting all the temptations. He's resisting the words of this creature. He finally makes it back to his house and he's trying to be all casual about it. At the last minute, he bolts for the window and the Kelpie then tries to attack. It realizes now is its chance. It tries to attack. He again swings with his claymore, gives it another chop.
I want one of these claymore things. They sound like
they're very useful.
Yeah.
And in this one swift movement, he throws the bridle through the window. It lands into the waiting hands of his wife and he dives for cover under the front door of his stone house. And the Kelpie can't strike because mounted above his front door is yet again...
A horseshoe?
Not a fucking horseshoe. The cross. He's got the cross.
Oh, the cross. Oh, well, I thought we were going down the path of like folkloric stuff. Okay, the cross.
According to the story, the Kelpie realized it had been foiled by Willix's supreme occult knowledge. And that's how he then used the bridle to become a famous warlock.
I kind of feel bad for it, but at the same time, I mean, it was going to drown him.
It was trying to eat people.
Yeah, so I get it.
I don't feel bad for it at all.
I just Googled a claymore. They are massive.
They're huge.
They're absolutely, it's like almost the size of me.
They didn't even need to be sharp. It was just the full force of something that heavy hitting you that would chop you in half.
Incredible.
Yeah. So, off the topic of claymores.
Yeah, sorry, I was distracted by weapons.
This occult origin of how he got his bridle kind of started off a series of sightings in the 1800s. This was the start, him passing away and this occult story of this how he gained his warlock powers started all these sightings. And remember, I stated the work of the historian who looked at Loch Ness and all the other bodies of water surrounding it.
Yes.
And you could actually find folklore in those other bodies of water, but not in other places. It turns out a lot of the sightings in the 1800s were actually land-based.
Oh, they weren't associated with water at all.
No, in 1880, there was the saga of E.H. Bright. He was with a friend. And another interesting detail, they're both children, 7 and 8 years old, during the sighting. Bright was strolling along the shore of Loch Ness with his buddy, and this beast apparently loomed out of the camouflage of an area of dense woodland. It was about 300 feet from the children at the time. They described it as being elephant-like in both size and colour. It had a long neck and possessed a very small head that was somewhat akin to a snake's head in terms of its shape. It also moved in a very strange fashion, an awkward waddle, which suggested that it wasn't used to being on land.
Yes.
And they said as it reached the water, it plunged into the depths and it was gone in a matter of seconds. Now, the kids ran home to their grandfather and told him what they'd seen. And typical story, he didn't believe them. He just tried to calm them down and said, look, you're having a bit of a laugh.
Overactive imaginations.
He goes down to the lake where they dragged him to tell him about the sighting. And according to the story, he found footprints in the lake. And it looked like large areas of the underbrush had been pushed over.
Yet again, though, it's fascinating that you have children reporting these encounters, especially going from last week's interview where it's like, is there something that children are seeing? Although that does sound like there's some type of physical force being used here.
Well, there's another story from Edward Smith. He's another famous researcher, and he was told by an elderly lady in the region who, with her two brothers, remembered a sighting again from 1880 when they were children. They're on the slopes next to the lake that overlook this old graveyard, and all of a sudden, the trio hear these unearthly noises coming from behind them. Turning around quickly, they're terrified to see a full-blown monster in their midst. Nick writes that according to the woman, the beast was larger than an elephant, had a thin, long neck, and moved in a side-to-side fashion. For a brief period, it peered at the three children and then waddled off to the loch and vanished underneath the water. So we're starting to see a pattern in the eyewitness descriptions, larger than an elephant. And I think they use the term elephant because
it's kind of what it looks like.
Well, the neck is long and thin, and it's always got a snake-like head at the end of it. And then you have another sighting from 1880, and this is the story of Duncan MacDonald. He was tasked to dive into Loch Ness at Johnny's Point and examine a ship that had sunk in the entrance to the Caledonian Canal at Fort Augustus. They took him down in one of those, almost like an old diving suit, to investigate what was down there.
Oh, like the big old-fashioned ones with the diving belt.
Yeah, I presume that's what it would be.
Right.
And according to him, or according to this story, he was lowered to around 30 feet and then suddenly started pulling to be hurled back up again. When they pulled him back to the surface, he was white as a ghost and he was terrified and he wouldn't say anything for 3 days. Just completely decimated this guy.
So he's spooked
some kind
by something.
Of weird PTSD happened under that water. So after the 3 days, he eventually admits to his crewmates what he saw. When he was down at that depth of 30 meters, he claims he turned and saw a frog-like creature perched on a rock shelf, and it was the size of a fully grown goat. An underwater rare Pepe staring at you in your diving suit. That is terrifying.
Unfortunately, though, you know the argument that we put forward by skeptics is that he was suffering from some kind of hypoxia or oxygen deprivation. That's where you kind of go. But then again, why would he see a Pepe far down?
Why would you see a Pepe?
Yeah, why not something else? So that is a bit strange. I'll give you that one.
He claims that he locked eyes with the rare Pepe for a brief moment, and that's what caused the PTSD. There was something about the locking
like
of eyes.
The hypnotoad for Futurama.
Yeah, that's probably a better pop culture analogy. It's a hypnotoad. And then we have this other weird story of this occurred in the early 18th century as well. There was a young couple who vanished while riding a horse and trap, which is like a carriage.
Yeah, a thing behind it.
Near the Loch End, and they just vanished. No one knows what happened to them. The suggestion was that they were murdered or abducted.
But Not by extraterrestrials, just in general, right?
Just in general. The horse was never found. The trap was never found. It was a really strange case. But 100 years later, during this insane thunderstorm, a young man and woman walk into a local almshouse inquiring to the local priest if they could have shelter for the night. So he gives them shelter, but he notices that this couple is very odd. They're dressed in clothing that is about a century out of fashion. And the way they talk is a little bit old-fashioned as well. And they just seem very dazed and confused and in this bizarre altered state.
Sounds like their time slipped.
Well, they stay in the almshouse for 2 days, and then he said they just vanished. No idea where they went. He didn't know about the story of the missing couple until he started telling some of the local villagers about this strange couple that turned up. He described their appearance, and some of the elders, some of the local people in the village told him this story of a couple that had vanished around 100 years ago.
See, we always hear stories of time slips from the other perspective, people that have actually experienced them where they've ended up in locations that seem like they're in the past. But you've got to think it can happen in the reverse as well. And people might say, well, it's just ghostly activity, but the fact that they seem dazed and confused and they're lost and they're finding somewhere to stay, it doesn't sound like a haunting. It sounds like it's some type of time slip. It's just a great little anecdote.
Well, it's the detail of them dressed in old-timey clothing.
Yeah.
Well. I think that's an important detail. Because if they just turned up and they were dazed,
It would be interesting if they handed over any objects or paid somehow or something like that. Yeah. That would be kind of cool.
Yeah. Well, then he goes into Aleister Crowley. And this is what's frustrating about the reviews of this book on Amazon.
Why?
Is you get a lot of people just going, why is he writing about Aleister Crowley? That's got nothing to do with the Loch Ness Monster.
Because, unfortunately, in some capacity, you are dealing with people that are limited to the physical. We're still stuck in this materialist kind of view that even when people start looking at this fringe phenomena, they can't accept that it actually goes beyond the physical.
You've got to mention Crowley.
Of course
if you're
you
talking
do.
About odd things with a Loch Ness Monster, the guy was living on Loch Ness for a great period of time. The guy that was the great beast, the ultimate occult practitioner of the 19th century.
Was he the sex magic guy that got people to throw up on boards and...
Yes.
Yeah, okay.
Remember, he was conjuring demons in Egypt. Everywhere the guy went, he was raising aliens from other dimensions and opening portals and communicating in the Enochian language and having weird sex rituals. The guy just would not stop. He was like the Elon Musk of occult ritual in the 19th century.
Very, very astute.
Just on top of the industry of summoning demons.
Yeah.
And no, we're not going to include him in the book because that's got nothing to do. Of course it's got to do with the Loch Ness Monster.
If he's that kind of guy into those sorts of things and he's hanging around at the Loch, it's not really a coincidence, is it?
Well, his goal at the time, I think this was in 1922.
Mm-hmm.
His goal was to perform what he termed the great operation of the sacred magic of Abramelin, the mage. And he needed a very specific location to perform the summoning of Abramelin the Mage.
Okay.
He needed, he wrote all this down. Like, he needed a door opening to the north of the room. He needed a specific oratory. He needed this place to end in the word lodge for some reason.
He's such an occult diva, though. All this stuff that he has to have to do these rituals.
He needed a bowl of only blue M&Ms.
Yes, exactly.
All those little details. He eventually found this magical location next to Loch Ness, and it was the Bolsken House. He felt an instant connection to us, this beautiful, old, but kind of spooky lodge right on the edge of the lake. And, yeah, he had a connection to it, but he also had a feeling that this house had a certain power to it. And he was convinced he could turn it into a portal or doorway through which supernatural entities and secrets could be channeled.
It's fascinating, though, that he thinks that there's some type of portal there and then you have all these sightings going on. Are these entities utilising this spot?
Well, as soon as Crowley moved in and started working on his new rituals and new books and new weird shit he used to get up to, all this horrible stuff started to happen to him and anyone that was connected with him.
Oh, so high strangeness.
At the time, he had another Golden Dawn colleague that was staying with him, and this colleague was meant to stay for 3 months. But eventually Crowley learnt one morning, the butler told him that his friend had just run off in the middle of the night because he was terrified after 3 weeks. He claimed that he was being tormented by spirits in the house. Following that, a couple of weeks later, Crowley comes home after a walk along the lake and he enters his study and he finds an old priest sitting there next to the fireplace. And he asks the priest what's going on. And the priest informs him that the keeper of the lodge house on the property, this guy that looked after the guest lodgings, had suddenly gone mad and for 3 days was in a strange hysterical state, and it ultimately finished with him trying to murder his entire family.
Sounds very Stephen King.
So the priest was there to let Crowley know that he needs a new guy to look after the lodgings. Things got worse, though. An old friend of Crowley's from Cambridge visited, and like his previous colleague from Golden Dawn, he intended to stay for quite a period of time, like 6 months. But he didn't succeed either. The friend was gone in less than 2 weeks after displaying panic attack type symptoms and telling Crowley in fear-filled tones, according to Redfern, that the Bolsken house was filled with terrible, malevolent spirits. So again, there's something supernatural going on, just happens to be next to Loch Ness.
Yeah, which is exerting, obviously, control or some type of influence.
Well, at the time, Crowley didn't connect it to the lock. Crowley thought there was a rival wizard in the Golden Dawn.
I like that.
Was cursing him.
Right.
The other things that happened was his entire pack of bloodhounds died under mysterious circumstances. His servants started to fall ill with all sorts of strange ailments. Then, worst of all, one morning, Crowley heard this wild, hysterical screaming coming from the kitchen. One of the workmen had suddenly snapped and, in this rage-filled psychosis, attacked Crowley's wife, Rose. Now, she survived the attack, but soon after, she was committed to an insane asylum.
Oh.
And it was later learned that she had early-onset dementia, and she was seriously alcoholic.
Right.
But this was all this string, a series of bad events that occurred to Crowley after he had moved into this place. A couple of years later, he left there. He was over it. Now, it's important that Redfern brings this up because what returned after Crowley leaves Loch Ness, the monster returns. You had this lull in sightings. You know, you had the occasional manuscript. You had some reports from the 1700s, a couple of 1600 cases, and all the folklore. But as soon as Crowley gets that house and does his weird rituals, which I'm sure he never wrote about them, but I'm sure he was doing weird shit every night.
Oh, of course he was. Yeah, of course.
As soon as he leaves, all the monster sightings return. Now, here's the thing, and this is where this links to Fae folklore. You'll love this detail.
Yeah.
Before 1933, and this is like a decade after Crowley's left, the only way to drive around Loch Ness was this old road that was constructed in the late 1700s.
Here we go.
And they say it was a road going around Loch Ness, but the closest it ever got to the water's edge was in extremely wooded areas, so you really couldn't see the water anyway. And in other areas of the road, you were just too far away, you couldn't see anything.
Yeah.
There was no way people could see the water. Now, in 1932, construction started of a brand new road that was going to open up the views of Loch Ness and get people driving and commuting much closer to the water's edge.
Well, it's a much better view.
But of course, what happens when you disturb the Fae sacred places? What happens when you move their stones?
Well, from our recent episodes, we know that they fuck with you.
Well, during the construction of the road, they needed to use a lot of dynamite to remove stone. Oh, large amounts of stone were removed. Huge amounts of stone were thrown into the lock. It was disturbing the water constantly. And you had this case soon after construction started, February 1932. James Cameron, a local mailman,
film producer.
Well, he was watching the stages of construction and he saw something strange on the lock. At first, he thought it was a boat that had capsized. But as he's watching this, it starts moving and undulating and re-enters the water. And he said this thing was absolutely huge. About a month later, you have Lieutenant Fordyce. This is April 1932. Fordyce decided to show his fiancée a bit of his homeland, Nick writes. The young lovers had a late evening romantic dinner. They strolled through the town and had an encounter with men playing bagpipes. Just a very romantic time in Scotland.
Were they spectral bagpipes at least?
But no, just normal bagpipes. Oh. Didn't give them any weird disease. But the next morning, they're driving back to Kent after their Scottish holiday. And as they're driving along this new road, this newly constructed part of the road that's right on the water, they hear this sound. They hear
camels.
It's not a camel. I know that sounds like a camel.
Sounds like a camel.
According to the Fordyce's memory of the event, they were driving at around 25 miles per hour when he and his fiancée were shocked and amazed by the sight of a large animal appearing from the dense woods and making its way across the road, and it was around 450 feet away from them. He added that the beast moved like an elephant, but appeared to be something akin to a strange combination of a camel and a horse, even to it having a camel-like hump on its back and a small head positioned on a long neck. Fordyce stopped the car, jumped out, and to his credit, he actually pursued this thing into the woods. He started following it. He got closer and still, kind of respecting the distance because he didn't want to get eaten.
Yeah.
And just observing this creature, he said it was grey in colour, but it also had wild and shaggy hair on its hindquarters. It reminded him of the trunk of an elephant, the way the front of its neck was moving. But anyway, he gets a little bit close and decides this is getting too dangerous, retreats to his car.
And, you know, we hear that so often with people that have encounters with these types of creatures. They go running after it, almost forgetting about the dangers, and then all of a sudden they stop and like, ooh, hang on, I don't know what this is. I shouldn't be chasing this.
Well, after the road's been constructed, we have this other account from April the 14th, 1933. Alex Campbell, he's splashed across the local papers because he claims that he was driving along the north side of the lock and they looked out over the lake and they saw almost like a whale breaching, this huge creature coming out and then slamming back into the water and going under. He said this thing was 20, 30 feet long. It was absolutely huge. 9 days after that story, the beast is seen again. Alexander Shaw and his son, they see a large wake develop, by, followed by an impressive set of, like an impressive sized back, sorry, breaking the surface of the water.
Definitely sounds like a whale.
They said it was about 30 feet in length. And then on June the 7th, you have a sighting from a pilot who's flying over the lock, and he sees something he describes almost like a giant alligator undulating through the water. So as soon as this road was built, you just had an absolute wave of sightings come through. Now, the maths work out because you've got more people looking at the water, more people can see it.
Yes. Well, it's much like the moon activity. It's like, oh, well, there's more car crashes that happen on full moons. Oh, by the way, it was a weekend.
But yeah, you can't deny the connection of Crowley suddenly appearing, considering his links to the entity Lam and all the other speculation of him summoning entities.
That's what makes me wonder. Is it possible that, yes, he went there looking for a portal, but did he somehow wedge it open? Does it only open in the past? I mean, if it's a natural phenomenon, does it only open at certain times? So when we go and mess with it, performing weird sex rituals and whatever else, that he left it ajar, and now these things started coming through more frequently.
Well, there's just so many more cases that followed this, and I don't think I've got time to do too many of them.
But Give us a couple.
There were some awesome details that continued. More on the way that this thing moved. There was a young couple who, again, were on a holiday. It was George Spicer and his wife. And again, this is 1933, 34.
So getting around to the time, though, where the activity was being picked up by more people.
Yeah, precisely. And as they're driving along, he said something was crossing the road that he said was an affront against nature. And it was moving across the road. And listen to the way he described it. He said it didn't move like a normal animal. It lumbered across the road in a series of odd jerks and coils, something which for Spicer and his wife, Redfern writes, was reminiscent of a massive worm. He said that by the time the shocked pair reached the section of the road where the monster had appeared, it was already gone. But again, there was evidence of it disturbing the woodland and disturbing the ground as it continued.
So there's something physical to it.
He also described the grey colour, which was another pattern that was continuing with the eyewitnesses.
Yes.
And said the beast was at least 5 feet in height and could have just destroyed their car. That's how powerful this thing looked. When they reported this to authorities, skeptics refer to this sighting as Spicer and his wife seeing, quote, a line of otters.
Otters.
That was the official explanation.
Hang on. You've got something so big that it could smash a vehicle, and yet the media is saying it's a line of otters.
Yep. Line of otters.
You know, I mean, it's a shame because it's almost ridiculous. I'm sure that, yes, these creatures, you know, they can be debunked. You can say, well, you know, people are imagining things or whatever else. But for the newspapers to say, oh, no, it's a line of otters, it's almost offensive to people that are saying, no, I've seen something. It's definitely not a line of otters. And it's insulting to the intelligence of the readers.
Well, one of the best sightings came 6 months after that from a guy named Arthur Grant. And he was a really keen motorcyclist. And he was riding one night, you know, no cars around, so you can go nice and fast.
Yeah.
And he came across this similar kind of creature crossing the road at 1 a.m. And he described it as having large flippers It had a 6 foot long tail, and he said the tail looked like it could wipe out a car on its own.
Do plesiosaurs have massive tails like that? It sounds like a plesiosaur.
Why do you say plesiosaur? Just because I said flippers?
Yeah.
Yeah. And it's funny that that's what pops into your mind.
Yeah.
But
and the long tail as well.
One particular thing that he described. He said the body was incredibly bulky. We don't get too much detail from Redfern on what he saw exactly, but the key part of his sighting is that the guy was a veterinarian.
Mm-hmm.
And he was also in the process of joining the Edinburgh-based Veterinarian Society.
So he knows what certain animals look like.
He reported his sighting to the Veterinarian Society.
Mm.
So the guy, yeah, understands zoology, and he's not going to risk his career by hoaxing a story about a line of otters crossing the road.
Yeah, exactly. I mean, there's potential. Who knows why people do the things they do? I mean, there's always potential that you could even have the most respected members of our community making these outrageous claims. Mm. But it's highly unlikely. You're right. No one's going to destroy their career over a little hoax just to get a rise out of the papers. I think it's very rare.
It was around this time that the plesiosaur theory really started to take hold.
Right.
That's where that started to build up its foundation. And still, like I said at the start of the segment, that's what most people think of today.
Mm.
But this is where we introduce the character Frederick Holliday. And this is a tale that Nick has gladly retold to us on the show a few times before, but I've never seen it put down in such detail as it's been recalled in this book.
Oh.
Frederick William Holliday, known to his friends and colleagues as Ted Holliday, was a very keen angler, but also a very large fan of all the folklore and stories surrounding Loch Ness. And in 1962, he made the trip of a lifetime. He went down to the Loch. He was a keen angler, so he had all his gear with him, but he also had cameras and lights. And in the back of his mind, he had a thought that maybe I'm going to capture the Loch Ness monster. Maybe I'm going to capture it on film.
But let's be honest, anyone who goes anywhere near Loch Ness would, in the back of their mind, go, "Ooh, I wonder if there's something out there."
Well, the first night he's camping by the water, he's awoken again at around midnight by this roaring sound of the camels.
Yeah. Thank you.
Yeah. And the water being incredibly disturbed. He hears the splashing and the sound of something large moving through the water. And he jumps out of his sleeping bag and tries to see in the moonlight what has caused this disturbance, but he can't see anything. But there was something else that he noticed that night, something really strong that stayed with him. It was a sense of foreboding. This strange feeling came over him. And the guy was well-traveled and had spent a lot of time with dangerous wildlife. He had been to Africa, Iraq, India. He'd been hunting in those places. You know, he'd never had this feeling before, this feeling of ominous foreboding. He actually said that Loch Ness is not a water by which to linger. The feeling is hard to define and impossible to explain. After dark, he said, I felt that Loch Ness was better left alone. So this feeling he just couldn't shake. And a mere 2 days later, as he scanned the waters, again, still camping, he caught sight of something large and black breaking the surface to the height of around 3 feet. Then without warning, the water churned violently and the thing plunged beneath the waves. And again, as he had this sighting, he felt that same earlier sense of foreboding overwhelm him, almost like a physical force taking over his body. Now, Ted Holliday became so obsessed with the Loch Ness Monster, he actually wrote a book about what he thought was behind all these sightings in the Loch. It was published in 1968 and was called The Great Orm of Loch Ness. And orm is this old medieval term for worm.
Okay.
He was really breaking the trend of it being a dinosaur, a plesiosaur.
Yeah.
He was going against the current theories. He claimed that the Loch Ness Monster was actually the Tullimanstrum, which is a worm that is only found in Oregon, of all places, or Pennsylvania.
But it's extinct.
It grows to about 14 inches long, and yeah, it's been extinct for 300 million years.
But 14 inches is different to something that can smash a car.
He claims this is an offshoot of that worm's ancestor, and it survived in Loch Ness. And the sightings of this creature are just that. It's a giant freaking worm.
I mean, it kind of lines up with some of the sightings, especially even those photographs that were taken, which have been, I don't know if they've been debunked or not.
Yeah, I mean,
but you get photos that show up that are like that.
He's breaking the trend, but it's still some old extinct thing that somehow survived. It's not that different.
Yeah.
Instead of a plesiosaur, he's just saying it's a worm. Still flesh and blood.
It's a little bit creepier, though, being a worm. I don't know why. Maybe it's, I don't know, it just puts me off being a worm.
Well, the thing is, after publishing his book, just even a few weeks or months after it's gone out and he's stirred up all this controversy for suggesting something else other than a plesiosaur, he starts getting this foreboding feeling. It's really starting to dominate his life, and he's feeling, I've missed something. There's something more to the Loch and the Loch Ness Monster that I've missed. And this is where he actually started to really go into detail and speak to eyewitnesses in the region who claimed they'd had sightings. And he started to see this unsettling pattern. And Nick points out there were a substantial number of records of people having cameras ready, having filming equipment ready to go, and for whatever reason, the equipment died. The pictures never came out developed. And in this book, Nick details some of the legendary photos that have appeared over the years. And I think one of the first ones from 1933, there's a little known fact that the guy who took that photo, it was his fifth or sixth shot. And the only reason we got that shot was because the rest of them just didn't develop.
Yeah, right.
There was something interfering with the film. And he just started to note this trend. Either people's equipment failed or something stopped them from taking the photo. Something messed with their heads, much like we hear from the UFO phenomenon.
Not just the UFO phenomenon, it's also what we're talking about recently with fae folk encounters, where there's some type of electromagnetic disturbance which disrupts cameras and other types of recording equipment. It's almost like it knows. Whatever the phenomenon is, if it's one thing or if it's lots of things, they know and they manipulate us to stop us from ever having unequivocal proof.
Well, Nick writes, it was as if the Nessies were dictating and manipulating the situations in which the witnesses found themselves, which is exactly what Holliday came to believe what was going on. He changed his mind, and after he decided that there's more to this, his life was dominated by weird synchronicities.
Interesting. Who else experienced that? Was it Jung that all of a sudden when he started looking at strange activity, he had all these synchronicities?
Yeah. It was Jung and Biggie Smalls, both of them. Serious weirdness.
Well, we all know how it turned out for Biggie Smalls.
In June of 1969, after he had come to this revelation, there was a coincidence of a trio of American students, Nick writes, who were investigating the grounds of the old cemetery that was right next to Aleister Crowley's old house.
Oh.
And as they're going through the cemetery, they're doing some excavations, they stumble upon this ancient piece of tapestry that's wrapped around an old sea snail shell. And as they unravel this, it's about 4 feet by 5 feet in size. It's this huge old scroll. And
does it end up being like the Shroud of Turin or something?
No, it's adorned with a snake-like image, or actually all these snake-like images. And it's got wording in Turkish that translates to serpent.
Oh.
Now, they actually approach Ted Holliday and invite him to examine it. And he starts to notice that the tapestry is adorned with this gold thread, specifically in the design of what he perceived to be thick, wormy creatures with long necks. Everything about this is about the great worms that he had spoken about. But also, there's this odd detail that the tapestry doesn't have any mildew on it. It's not damp in any way. So Holliday believes it was placed there on purpose.
Being some type of time capsule or record?
It's like it's been put there the day before the excavators got there.
Oh, to act as an artifact. And obviously if you find something like that, then you can't proceed. Is that what he's suggesting?
It's some kind of, maybe a warning. It's definitely been planted there recently. So Holliday starts to ask the local innkeepers, the local owners of the house, Crowley's former house, to ask if they'd seen anyone in this area the day before or the previous day. And they said, no, we haven't seen anyone. We don't know what you're talking about. There hasn't been anyone around. Holliday starts to investigate, and eventually he discovers that the serpentine tapestry, along with the links to the Bolskin house, Crowley's old house, are indicative of a highly secret, a very powerful, and maybe even deadly dragon cult operating in Loch Ness.
A dragon cult?
It's a cult, Redfern writes, that worshipped the supernatural Nessies by night and which perhaps made sacrifices to the beasts under a starry, chilled sky, possibly even human sacrifices.
Okay.
So you can see it's not even an ancient thing. 1965, there's a night on the loch. You hear this, a hooded monk takes the screaming baby and lays it out as an offering to the Nessies. The monster comes up. Where's my camel sound?
Oh, God. Oh.
Snatches the baby into the lake and the gods are appeased.
That's terrible. That's truly terrible.
This is what he thinks is going on. There is a dragon cult still in operation in Loch Ness.
But where do you get the babies from?
I kind of added that detail in just to spice it up
a bit. Oh, right.
But there's definitely babies involved.
Okay, provocative theory.
Yeah, it makes it a bit edgier if you put babies in.
Well, but the thing is, like, if anyone is being sacrificed, though, I mean, any life, obviously a baby, I guess, is worse, but I mean, what? People just are disappearing? Is that what's happening to missing persons?
The point that Redfern's getting at is that Holiday's world is starting to unravel. He's gone from flesh and blood worm creatures in the loch to dragon cults doing human sacrifice and secret occult magic with Aleister Crowley. Now, the mysterious group in question, Holiday believed, were worshippers of Tiamat, the Babylonian snake goddess. She mated with Abzu, the god of fresh water, to create a number of supernatural offspring, all of them dragon and serpent-like in appearance.
Fascinating.
So
a lot of links showing up here, isn't there?
There's the idea that this group were, or maybe even Crowley himself, were doing rituals to summon Tiamat, the Babylonian goddess, and their demonic serpent-like offspring. They came through Crowley's portal, and now they're in the lake.
So I don't understand, though. Is that the connection? Did Crowley have some type of connection to this group, or this group is just, you know, going from Crowley's strange works?
I don't know. Pretty sure Crowley would have been up to no good.
Yeah, I mean, I know. He's a bit of a...
I mean, he wasn't just doing laundry and cooking dinner for his wife.
No.
He was doing weird sex magic every night.
Yeah. We know we covered some of those stories.
I know.
They're pretty much...
very sticky stories involving Crowley.
Filthy, filthy stories.
But look, there's also the dreaded Scorpion Men, equally hideous offspring of Tiamat that were, as their name suggests, a horrific combination of man and giant arachnids.
So Spider-Man, basically.
Spider-Man, basically.
Yeah,
so Spider-Man's involved.
I don't necessarily know if I buy that one.
Anyway, the high strangeness continues with Holiday. A year after this tapestry is found in the cemetery next to Crowley's old house, he goes out to dinner with an underwater engineer friend of his named Robert Love. And also along for this dinner is an American friend of Love's named Dr. M. D.
D as in John D.?
Yeah.
No. And John D., the alchemist kind of assistant to Queen Elizabeth?
We'll explain this in a second. He's having dinner, and at the end of the dinner, after Holiday's friend Love, the engineer, excuses himself to the bathroom, this guy, Dr. M.D., leans in and menacingly says,
"Have you got a baby?
Do you know that I'm related to John D., the famous occultist?" And then kind of leans back. Now, to you or I, that just seems like a weird, awkward thing to say at dinner. But Holiday takes this as a threat and a warning. Because as you started to mention there, John Dee was famously, the Queen's first Secret Service agent. He was in channeling entities from another dimension. He invented the Enochian language that they communicated to him. He was working for the King of Belgium to turn straw into gold.
I like it, though, that you just say that we'd be like, oh, that's a strange thing to say at dinner. I mean, this guy would be leaning in, making a threat. I'd be like, oh, my God, that is so cool. Can we go and summon something? I'd be completely in awe of it.
Let's do a story on it. Come into the studio.
Yeah, why not?
So after this ominous threat, it's a couple of weeks later and Holiday's scouring the loch. He's looking for the monster.
Yeah.
And he suddenly notices this strange yellowy form appearing in the water on the shore. He goes to investigate and he sees the letters E-D-E-E spelt out in the water.
E-D-E-E.
Yeah.
As in his initials.
As in John D. Spelt out in this strange soil in the water. And as he goes to look closer, it kind of goes...
But why would it? But why would it be E?
I don't know. It's just John D. It's weird and it's high strangeness.
Right.
Don't ask too many questions.
It adds some confusion just to throw you off.
You can see where Redfern's going with this because Holiday's starting to go insane.
Yeah.
I mean, he's seeing letters spelt out saying John D in the waves of the of Loch Ness.
Guy's losing it.
It's absolutely nuts. Then on August the 13th, 1971. Graham Snape contacts Ted Holiday because he knows this guy's into all the weird stuff going on over the lock, and he reports a UFO sighting. There was a UFO sighting over the lock.
It's almost obligatory now.
3 days later, he hears from Jan Ove Sundberg, a 23-year-old Swede, who recounts that he was in a section of the woodland above Foyers Bay, just outside the lock, 8:30, I think it was 8:30 in the morning, this account, and he stumbles across a landed UFO, again, in the woodland just outside Loch Ness. This Swedish guy walks up, and at first he thinks it's some kind of car or odd vehicle, and as he's getting closer...
An odd vehicle, all right.
He says in his initial report, three divers come out of the woods, look at him for a moment, and then board this craft. The craft rises up into the air and vanishes. Now, at first, he thought they were divers because they were wearing helmets with breathing apparatus and all this gear.
Sounds like humanoid reports, though.
But yeah, it's just this weird UFO sighting just outside Loch Ness. He goes and tells Ted about this sighting. Ted, of course, is starting to unravel because now he's getting light seen in the sky over Loch Ness. Forget about monsters in the lake. This is now aliens and flying saucers and yeah. John D and all this weird stuff.
It's the next level.
Compiling on him. Now, as a little side note, this Swedish guy, Sundberg, he claims that when he returned to Sweden, he was harassed by men in black about this sighting. But finally, this all culminates on June the 2nd, 1973, where there's a full-blown exorcism on Loch Ness.
And this by whom?
This involves Donald Amand. He's a doctor and a reverend. And there's a story of how, well, Amand basically thought that there was something to the monsters in Loch Ness, but they were Satan. They were the devil.
Right. Demonic.
Part of the reason he went down this path of thinking is because he had had his own sightings on the loch, actually in Loch Long, one of the other water bodies near Loch Ness. And he had told a close friend of his, this Norwegian sailor named Jan Andersen. And after he told Jan this story, Jan said, you know, you should come with me to the Fjord of the Trolls in Norway. It's the most haunted body of water in the world. Mm. Come with me and you'll see some strange stuff. So Ormond agrees. And in June of 1968, they're on this trip to the Fjord of the Trolls. And just like his own sighting in Scotland a year earlier, they're on this boat and the water starts to boil. And they see, as if on cue, a pair of large dark-coloured humps rise from the depths and then head directly towards their boat. Now, Captain Jan Andersen, the Norwegian guy, he reassures Ormond and says, look, the animal's not going to bring any harm to us. And sure enough, as it gets closer, it dives beneath the water and disappears. They don't see it any longer. And Ormond says, look, how did you know it wasn't dangerous? And this Norwegian guy says, look, I knew it wasn't going to hurt us physically, but I didn't say it wasn't dangerous. He said, these creatures are evil, but they're not interested in disrupting the bodies of us on the boat. What they're interested in is the minds and the characters of everyone on this boat. The point of them is they provoke anxiety. They provoke paranoia.
Yeah, it's like the shadow person encounters. They feed on the negativity. They feed on the fear.
Well, he claims their ultimate goal was mental collapse.
Mm.
They get into your mind. Now, Ormond was clearly incredibly influenced by this. He wrote about it. Ted Holiday read Ormond's writings on it and was blown away. With all his high strangeness experiences, he realized this guy gets it. He understands what's at stake here. This is not a flesh and blood creature. This is something more serious. This is a supernatural entity that doesn't have our best interests at heart. We've got to do something about it. So they decide to do an exorcism.
Well, what else are you going to do?
Out they go on a boat, and it's all approved by the local diocese.
Yeah.
It's all approved.
All right.
They're on the boat, and there's an old army captain that arrives because he's intrigued. The press is there. There's a photographer there. The BBC ended up doing a recreation of this.
So this is the 70s?
This is 1968.
Right, okay. I think. Yeah, that kind of range, though.
Don't quote me on that. Anyway, as the story goes, they're going out onto the lock, and he starts exercising the water itself. They go to different locations, but he's saying, "I exercise thee, O creature of the salt, by the living God, the true God, the holy God, by that God, the prophet Eliseus, command thee to be cast out." And the monster's like, bleh.
Yeah.
I told you I'd have high quality sound effects for this session.
You have done excellent work, Benjamin.
He continues and says, in whatsoever place thou shalt be sprinkled, all illusions and wickedness and crafty wiles of Satan may be chased away and depart from that place.
I could be wrong, but I'm pretty sure he didn't say thou shall be sprinkled.
And the monster's like,
what is this?
I went into our top tier quality library of sound effects.
Isn't that from that What Is Your Spirit Animal website? Is that
yes.
What you, yeah, okay.
And
yeah.
Just as an aside, today I found the giraffe jazz one.
Oh my God.
And that's it.
Where's the sound of the giraffe?
There's not even a giraffe at the end of it. It's really disappointing.
No,
it's
I think
just
it'll
shitty MIDI jazz.
What sounds do giraffes make?
Just bleh. Really big camel.
Yeah.
So anyway, he does this exorcism, and by the end of it, when they're going ashore, he's exhausted. He can't move. They're trying to haul the reverend ashore. They have to help him up. And he says, oh, this is just normal with an exorcism. Don't worry about it. But Holiday recalls that the photographer has gone pale. And for all of them, again, this strange sense of foreboding came over them. They had the feeling that they had disturbed something, or they had pulled some mystical levers, and they were just waiting to see what was going to happen next.
They need to close the door, the doorway. It's been left ajar by Crowley. They need to shut it.
Well, dark forces, Redfern writes, seem to be hovering ominously around the area for weeks later. Several days after this exorcism, Holiday took a nighttime drive to the home of Basil and Winfred Carey to get their views on that UFO encounter that the Swedish guide had, right?
Yeah.
Now, this woman, Winifred Carey, she wasn't like a wacky psychic. She was very down to earth, but it was just word got around that she had abilities. Mm-hmm. She worked for the special operations executive during the Second World War. She'd spent time in India where maybe she picked up her abilities. But anyway, he approached her for advice on this UFO encounter. And as he's asking her about this encounter, because he wanted to go back out to the location and do some field work, she suddenly gets very scared and says to Holiday, whatever you do, stay away from that site of the UFO landing. Don't go near it. She warned him that if he went there, it would be an absolute disaster. It could cost him his life. Now, as she was saying this, she claimed that an evil presence had entered the room and was hovering around and listening to her words as she spoke to Holiday. At that moment, as she realizes this presence has arrived, this whirlwind-like sound fills the air, and this shadowy smoke monster from Lost starts spinning around, knocking everything out of its way in the room, and leaves through the window.
What the hell? That's amazing.
Crazy activity.
But again, the high strangeness, the moment that you start looking at these topics, you start delving into them, it goes from just being a simple, strange, flesh and blood creature, which is turning up in the lock, to being smoke monsters that are harassing you.
Well, ultimately, this gets us to the part of the story that we usually prompt Nick to retell. And this is where the following day, after this smoke monster encounter in this woman's house, Holiday's taking another walk down to the lock. And as he does this, he sees a man in the distance about 90 feet away. He's standing atop a slope, and whoever this character is, he's not looking at Loch Ness. he's looking straight at Holiday. And Holiday has this feeling come over him that this is not right. There's something not right about this guy. And this curious character, Nick writes, he's dressed entirely in black from head to toe. And Holiday describes what he's wearing as some kind of black plastic. His hands are gloved as well, and his head is covered by something that looks almost like a motorcycle helmet. It's black as well, obviously. He's wearing goggles that are covering his eyes, and even his nose and mouth are covered by a strange black band made of some kind of cloth. Now, Holiday starts to tentatively walk towards this strange man in black. This character doesn't move or move his eyes in any way. He's just staring at Holiday. Holiday gets this idea to then feint some kind of collapse. He thinks in his mind, I'm going to collapse and see if this stranger will come and help me, because he thinks he's going crazy. He's not sure if this thing is real or not. And as soon as he has this thought, this strange whistling sound and all these unintelligible whispers fill the air, and this strange man in black vanishes, dematerializes in front of him. He's gone.
Is he having a stroke? Like, I'm listening to this going, how would you process this? What does he do?
Well, here's the kicker to the story, and this is the one we love to, again, hear Nick retell, is he's so shaken up by this, but he continues on his research with Loch Ness, the Loch Ness Monster. 1 year later, he's on that same very spot that he had the encounter with the man in black, and he doesn't remember that this is the spot until he starts to have a serious heart attack. He collapses, clutching his chest, and as he's being taken away in the ambulance, that's when he realizes, shit, this is the same spot that I saw that strange man in black.
Oh, yes. Yeah.
You remember the story?
I do, yeah. Isn't that crazy?
So all this culminates in this high strangeness, and this is just one of the stories that are included in the book. And I focus on this because it's got a really long thread. But Nick also includes, you know, tales of the white witch that's associated with Loch Ness.
There's I've never heard that.
There's all these stories of the military being involved, all sorts of awesome stuff, great reasons to pick up the book. But at the end, he says, look, make no mistake, the Loch Ness Monster is real. It exists. But it's the nature of reality and the nature of that existence that so many need to come to grips with and learn to accept.
Yes, absolutely. Very valid point.
Such a great point. Mm. You know, it's clearly not just something that's flesh and blood, something purely physical. We're dealing with something else which causes us to question the nature of reality.
At the very least, I mean, it could be something going on there which is some type of, it's a pop culture thing, but it is a body of water which is generating attention. It's getting people to look at it and to be intrigued by it. There's not a lot of other bodies of water out there that have the same kind of effect. So at the very least, it's influencing our culture. And at the very most, it's possibly some type of phantasmal creature that's demonic and influencing people.
Yeah.
Just yeah. Oh, God. What is that?
This is the rhino song.
You know, I've never hit a giraffe or a rhino. I've got a camel once. Oh. That sounds like an ostrich anyway.
I love it when it's got it at the end. It's so good.
I like the unicorn one. I'm sorry, but I do.
I've got the elephant one.
Is that site still up? What is that website?
PowerAnimalsUnleashed.com.
That's right. Yes. How could I forget? I should just check mine. What the hell is that? Oh, that's on there.
Godzilla!
Oh, dear, oh, dear, oh, dear.
Highly recommended. Nessie, Exploring the Supernatural Origins of the Loch Ness Monster. Nick Redfern, we'll link to it in the show notes. You know the drill. Thanks for listening. That's a wrap-up of this Plus episode.
That's it.
Do you have anything else?
No, that's fine.
Where's my Nigerian sex dollar story? Where's the story of the guy in Zimbabwe who found a demon inside his bottom and got it out with a stick?
To be honest with you,
where are those stories?
You traumatized me with a minotaur penis. Absolutely traumatized me. It affected my social relationships with my friends. I thought, I can't have any of those stories. I just have to have a nice, clean episode of Mysterious Universe Plus.
It's involuntary at this stage. Like I said,
this is the problem, Ben.
MU Tourette's. It's like I was getting a haircut the other day And the guy asks, what do you guys talk about on your radio show?
You're just like, middle penis.
And I said to him, well, have you ever seen the video of a fat Filipino lady slipping over in butter?
Yeah, that too!
That pretty much sums it up, sir. And that's all you need to know. And then nothing else was said for the rest of the haircut. And that's the way it should be.
And the meat slap.
What the fuck is wrong with you?
The meat slap.
Can we please finish this show? This yes, is why we need to have a story at the end.
I'm done.
Thanks for listening. We'll catch you on Friday for your next MU. See you then.